Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cannibalizing the Canon. I am one of your hosts, Glaive slash Danny slash whatever the heck you want to call me.
I am V slash Vela slash Ren slash three dogs in a trench coat. Woof, woof, let's go.
And we're joined by a guest.
Hello.
Welcome, Miles underscore Dobson.
That, like, we do our standard intro, and this is the face of a man who's never listened to this podcast, because you were just like,
I don't know whether you wanted me to, like, join in. Not that I haven't listened to the podcast.
It's fine.
Am I supposed to have a okay.
Here's the thing, Miles. Every time
I've got it.
Do the introduction, I always try and get V off guard by just changing last second what I say. Like, oh god, it's fine. Okay. It's what we do.
Not today, motherfucker.
Hang on. Do the intro again. I'm ready.
I'm Glaive slash Danny slash whatever you want to call me.
I'm V slash Vela slash Rin slash three dogs in a trench coat. Woof woof. Let's go.
And I'm your grandmother at a wedding that really wants to tell you about that guy that's shifty at the supermarket, Miles Dobson.
Oh, man, that was a deep cut.
Speaking of great storytelling, segue.
Wow!
The episode today is storytelling in video games, as chosen by our guests.
Yeah!
Heck yeah! I am the king of segues.
Yeah, that was incredible. Congratulations on that one. It was flawless.
It's the quality content that people tune in for. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely.
When I pull stuff out of my ass at a constant basis. So, Miles, I can see here, you want to talk about Half-Life.
this is a podcast about, you know, you're basically storytellers.
As
DMs and experienced veterans.
I like him. He can come back. He knows how to lay on the flattery. I'm here for it.
Listen, always flatter the hosts. So I think that video gaming has come a long way in storytelling, and I think that as DMs, you were probably very inspired by the way that games have done storytelling, and that's translated into the work that you've done in Dungeons and Dragons. And so I wanted to kind of talk about the road that we've gotten on to get going from Frogger to The Last of Us, you know, because it's quite the jump.
Before we go any further, dear listeners, just a quick heads up. There may be spoilers for any of the games we mention.
Oh.
Just be aware.
Yes.
So, like, this, we're going to be going in, like, it's going to be wild. There may be spoilers. There may not. I don't know. But if you
hear
a game name and you think, I haven't played that and I want to, maybe just take a break. Maybe just come back next episode.
We could do a thing where, like, anytime you want to mention a spoiler, we'll tell the audience, like, hey, you know that 10-second skip? Push that now.
That sounds way too organized for us.
It'll be fine. We'll have the emergency spoiler duck that will quack whenever there is a spoiler coming in.
That
and
is
the duck will have
a different
pitch every time. Different pitch of quack every time. In fact, it could be a different species of duck every time.
Okay. So what you're saying is you want an assortment of birds.
No, ducks.
Ducks. Every time. Okay, so I'm just making a note for my editing. It also says Miles is going to die.
I mean, here's the thing. If you do
episode
do this,
ends immediately.
Miles, you're like, because we're still like in the early, like this is episode 17, so this is like, you might be adding a fundamental part of the canon of
the
podcast.
Canon of canon. I love it.
Okay, if this becomes a canon of canon, I reserve the right to announce at the end of every episode how much I hate Miles for it.
Yeah, sure.
Wait, that was, have I been skipping over? I thought that was a thing that I just skipped over at the end of every episode that you did.
We have shout out to David and also death to Miles Dobson. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Okay,
also,
great.
We got We Love Bex, but that's, you know.
Bex. That's a very recent one, even though we've always loved Bex. So.
Yes, indeed.
All right, so yeah. Half-Life. This funny thing you say, talking about the inspiration as us as game masters, I have this thing I call GM canon, which is every storyteller has it, but like GMs in specific, we draw from a lot more wider base, specifically video games. because of the fact that video games has a lot more freedom for the viewer to do stuff. And Half-Life is a brilliant example because I think it's a really good example of what people think is railroading, but is more how a lot of GMs just run a game anyway.
It's because it's a very linear game.
Exactly.
It's incredibly linear, but it never feels like it to the player because of the way that they incorporate storytelling into their design. And I don't, you know, if you haven't played Half-Life, it is a genre defining and like pinnacle moment in storytelling because of the way that they decided to move away from cutscenes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you know, before that, it had always been like removing agency from the player for a moment to allow something cool to happen to the player, but they have no control over it. And in Half-Life, it happens to you all the time. And they used very new techniques at the time to get your attention. So they might have a big set piece about to happen, and they'll have like one guy there shoot at you so that you look at it, and then immediately as soon as you look at it, it'll trigger the event, which then makes that set piece of storytelling happen. I feel like you could that might be a thing that you incorporate into D&D because it's the same kind of thing of like, you have three paths and you want the players to go down one path. Perhaps you try and like, you go like, oh, and there's an enemy this way that you might want to kill and those kind of things.
Hilariously, we did an episode on set pieces. We've done it twice now.
Well, it's so integral, yeah, right? It's
exactly,
so integral.
Exactly. Sorry.
It's interesting because Half-Life really set the tone for how that is done now, but it's interesting kind of looking back in between Half-Life and now and how many games actually incorporate that and how it has definitively changed how we tell stories in video games. Like, as you were saying it, my brain immediately went to Skyrim because that happens all the time. Things happen around you and you kind of see things happen. You don't necessarily have to go and get involved in it, but it's like a cutscene is happening in front of you. Sort of thing.
Two other good examples that just popped in my head when you're saying that, because games to this day are still trying to do the same thing as Half-Life, but in different ways. So I'm thinking of the original Assassin's Creed, which was the first one where like, oh, you can move around while the characters are talking to you. It's a cutscene, but it's a cutscene where you can still do things. Not much, but that's like a moment of like, oh, okay. And the other thing I think much, much bigger than that, the new God of War series.
Oh god!
Yeah, absolutely.
God. Literally. Sorry.
Available for hire at all parties.
Yeah, he's a professional, guys. God of War is like a perfect example of where we started with Half-Life and where we've gotten to. It's incorporated so many elements from Valve's work in storytelling, Naughty Dog's work in storytelling, stuff like Spyro or whatever, you know, like regular or Mario, like platformers. It's all incorporated into this phenomenal way of
maintaining player autonomy.
Absolutely. The player has autonomy, but it never feels like, even when it's a cutscene, it never feels like you're not involved in what's happening. And it's a marvel. It's a marvelous bit of work. And there's a reason why it's won so many awards and everyone's so excited for the new one, you know?
Heck yeah. That's why so many people are excited. So both instances of that. So we've got like God of War and everyone's super excited about the continuation of that, which, you know, we're much more likely to see than the continuation of Half-Life.
Absolutely.
Half-Life 3 when though?
Yeah, right. I mean, like, it's interesting because you talk about Half-Life Alyx, which is in the VR space, and they had to rejig everything they learned from Half-Life 1 and 2 because the player is like totally involved there. Like there's no separation between the player and the game when you're in virtual reality.
Yeah, it's total immersion.
And so it's, so they still had to try and like figure out new ways to get the player's attention without, you know, taking away agency, especially when it's, you know, the person could easily take a step left during a cutscene and then pass through a wall and not see what happens during that cutscene, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's something you have to account for. You know, if you lose balance during a cutscene because the cat rubbed up against your leg or whatever, or the dog jumped on you, you might miss a vital piece of information which would otherwise be taken. I wanted to go back to Skyrim briefly, though, because there's a story. I played Morrowind. I've not played Skyrim. I'm sorry, please don't kick me off the podcast now. I've never played Skyrim.
No, you're fine.
20th anniversary.
You haven't, considering how many, like,
versions of it. Absolutely.
Like, I'm pretty sure you can play Skyrim on the fridge now.
I'm sure if you looked at it hard enough, you could find it for free.
There's also a... I think I play it on my Texas Instruments calculator.
Yeah.
It's the new Doom.
I can't say the word. Yeah, it's the new Doom, exactly. I just remember with Morrowind, I think it's like in the first village or something. You're walking along a path and you just hear a guy go, and then you come over a hill and there's just a wizard dead on the floor and he has a potion. And that's all you've got is just like a dead wizard on the floor with a potion. And do you remember, neither of you know this?
No.
This is burnt into my brain because it took me, let me finish this story because it's pinnacle of what I'm talking about, which I love, but I was dumb as a kid. So I drank that potion and it's a jumping potion.
Oh no.
But the jumping potion doesn't have any kind of like falling cushioning. Mm-hmm. So like I spent possibly a good day trying to figure out what I was doing wrong because I kept dying. Because I don't think he had any like parchment on him saying like, got to figure out how the landing thing or something like that. There was nothing like that. It was just dead wizard potion. Oh yeah, all right, I'll give that a try. And then consistently died over and over again for a day. And then I just gave up. But like, that level of like, I think that's the other side of the coin when it comes to player agency, because if you don't story tell enough, like in Half-Life, you tell story enough for the player to know what's going on, but not for them to like not grasp it enough and then completely ruin the immersion and ruin the game. But then, like, on the flip side, in Morrowind, you just give them a thing. And that's happened to me in D&D, where something happens, and I'm like, what is happening? Am I, like, and then I end up being turned inside out because I was walking through my own stomach.
Oh. Oh.
That's rough.
That's a new one. But that wizard you find that's dead on the floor, I'm sure at some point I've done that.
You telling that story was giving me full on PTSD style flashbacks to something I did to my players, which was I rolled on a random events table and it was a solar eclipse. So a solar eclipse happened. They spent out of game time an hour discussing what this meant.
Oh, and no.
I am there, head in my hands, like it's an eclipse. It doesn't mean anything. But they're so determined to see the patterns in everything.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, I mean, to be fair, that has happened, like, historically. Like, an eclipse happens in the middle of a battle, and everyone's like, oh, shit. We're going to go home.
Yeah.
They were just walking down a road, and an eclipse happened, and boy, howdy. I have never heard the end of that one.
God. No, so it's I think there's, you know, you talked about God of War. We've got Alex and God of War, which are kind of like, I would say, the forefront of storytelling in games. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you go backwards to like Half-Life, but then in between that, there was a lot of different attempts at storytelling that I think are worth talking about. Metal Gear Solid, for one, is the most
critically
acclaimed and most cult classic Metal Gear Solid.
I mean, you can't name many games where the creator is as big a name as the game itself. Like, you've got, like, I don't consider, Gabe, no, great, but I don't consider him, like, the sole, like, mastermind behind the Valve games. I just consider him someone that's in charge of the company. Yeah. Whereas Hideo Kojima is someone else.
the word that's thrown around a lot is auteur, and I think that's quite poignant.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
For Hideo.
I would definitely say Faye Trickster God, but that's just me. I mean, I assign that to anyone I don't understand.
Faye Trickster God or someone who traded with a Faye Trickster God.
Oh, no, straight up Faye Trickster God. There's definitely no. Here.
But here's the thing, though, because we also have seen the other side of the sword now, which is Death Stranding? Standing?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Death Stranding, yeah.
Which, I feel like that's what happens when you do not put any restrictions on him whatsoever, and it's the George Lucas effect. There's all yes men all around going like, yes, whatever you say, sir. Yep, mm-hmm. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. And once it hits the public, who have no such loyalty, I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I want to go across a landscape delivering shit, because that reminds me of my job.
Yeah, this cuts a little too close to home, quite frankly.
Yeah.
The silence before you specifically outlined that argument was very telling. It was that kind of like, not sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think you're certainly right that he's kind of gotten a bit too carried away with his own ego a little bit, mm-hmm. when it comes to his writing. But when you look at his, you know, and you know, he was very happy with story being told via cutscene. But I think that's because he really wanted it to be like a movie.
I mean, famously, like, Metal Gear Solid has the longest cutscenes. Where it's like, all right, I'll go make some tea.
Was it Metal Gear Solid 4?
Which is like 3 hours of cutscenes.
Which is honestly just a film, right? Like,
yes.
That was the running joke. I remember it coming out, and I remember every time I came in to see my partner at the time who was playing it, it was always a cutscene. And I'm like, statistically, this is ridiculous.
Mm.
Every time I walk in the room, it's another cutscene. Really? Okay, sure.
Well, funnily enough, in terms of D&D, the equivalent of that, or RPGs in general, so the audience members who listen to this work solely for the D&D. We'll mention every now and again, but video games this time. The equivalent to that is exposition dialogue. When the dungeon master is explaining a thing of like, you see the grand mountain and its light above, and you see the wizard Akhnok, and he's yelling at the sky, where the players can't do stuff. And you're just standing there listening to all these explanations. And if you don't do it right, it's just like throwing softballs at them. And they're like, ow, ow, ow.
Yeah.
I want to do something,
so,
please.
So, as experienced DMs, what do you try to stay away from that kind of description of the world? Like, is there a time and a place for that kind of establishing descriptive work, or do you often just say you're in a forest and then something happens and then you allow the players to kind of work out what's happening on their level?
On their level works a lot better, because that's like you meet them where they are in terms of how much attention they want to give, because it's a frequent thing when you're game mastering where like you'll be really into this because you made it. You're like, look how amazing this is. Look how great and detailed. But they don't want anything of it because they don't get to hit it with a sword. It's like, cool. Great. So you just give them bite-sized chunks and slowly but surely. And then if anyone like has the slightest hint of like a fascination, you jump on that. And like, all right, cool. Here's a bit more.
It also, especially in terms of like, when you're placing them into the world, you say, hey, you're in a forest. Okay, go nuts kind of thing. For them, you are essentially serving as their eyes, because everything that you describe is everything that they can see. So if they don't want to look around, they don't want to look around. You don't give them that information. And if they end up falling into a trap because they didn't look around, that's kind of their own fault. But equally, it's the same with kind of like lore and history of the world. Like, there might be stuff that they know because that's how their character was built, but you wouldn't necessarily throw that at them all in one go. You're like, okay, hey, it's session one, and here's all the stuff you know about the world. Like, that would be just tedious.
Too much.
Unless they specifically ask for it in the session zero.
I find when players ask questions and you give them the little bit of answers as they come, that's a lot better than just giving it all.
Plus, if you do it in the session zero, you can work with them and they can help you build that.
Yeah.
Which is A, great in terms of getting someone invested because, hey, they helped build this and isn't that cool? And B. Also B, way less work for me. All right.
Yeah, because I started watching Critical Role because I am a noob. And it's taken me this long to get on it. And the amount of opening descriptive work that goes into describing the world, you know, it's my understanding that Critical Role is like the pinnacle when
it
comes
to, but there is something called the Matt Mercer effect.
Right. Okay. Do you want to explain the Matt Mercer effect? Cause I don't know this.
The Matt Mercer effect is the effect of, because of Critical Role, a lot more people are playing Dungeons and Dragons and they're going in expecting the Critical Role levels of gaming. But a lot of GMs, and it's not their fault, it's their game, they get to run as well, but they're all professional actors and voice actors and improv experts, and they know how to be funny, they know how to pay attention, they know how to yes and. Normal players do not know how to do that, and neither do GMs. So GMs, the Matt Mercer effect is too high expectations, and it's our job as GMs to be like, okay, that's good, but you have to maybe go down a little bit. Not lower your expectations, but just accept the fact that my game is going to be different from Matt Mercer's game.
It's this idea that, like, and it's interesting that, like, you in particular saying that, like, you know, Critical Role is the pinnacle. A lot of people do see it that way because Critical Role was really kind of the trailblazer in terms of getting D&D back out of this kind of
mother's
basement situation into, hey, this is cool and cool people play this, and hey, anyone can play this, which is, don't get me wrong, I will always be really grateful to them for that, because I have seen as a result so many different kinds of people coming to the table, and that's wonderful. But it is just one table in a sea of millions, and the added problem is that they are very aware that they are putting this on as a show now. So there is that kind of elevated element of descriptive work, because they can talk to each other. They've been working together, especially this game, for like 5-6 years now. They know what kind of stuff they're used to. They know the kind of pictures that Matt is painting for them because they've done this before. But the audience doesn't necessarily know that, especially at the start of a new campaign where it's in a different world setting or a different part of the world, and it's not what they're used to from all the fan art of previously. So they're kind of like, okay, well, this is how this looks and this is how that looks, and they have to, and Matt in particular has to put a little bit extra legwork in that.
There's also this interesting point to make, is that Critical Role makes a lot of money, as per a relatively recent Twitch leak that we discovered.
Yes,
we know precisely how much money they get from Twitch.
Yes, almost. And no, but we're not getting into that today.
We're not getting into that. But
we're getting into that today because I can always talk about that.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole rabbit hole.
That's a whole other thing.
But point is that Mercer has time to do that. Mercer has time to invest in creating world. Much like an entire video game company has time to, like, build up this world that you can just walk around.
Yeah. I mean, that's literally his job now. Like, yeah, he's still a voice actor and still a very successful voice actor, but the majority of his time is within this company building this game.
Me
building
and
these worlds.
Do not have production assistants building sets for us and making sure the lighting is correct and doing all the things that come together to make the Critical Role.
I got a camera and some fairy lights. Let's go.
I've got a cat that I can throw at the players every now and again.
Oh, no. More deadly than any beholder. But also, I mean, the other factor in that is time. Most GMs or DMs will have jobs and lives and other commitments. And even if it's one game a month, they still need to find the time to build that stuff. And if they're really crazy people, they'll have multiple games a month. A week. Why would you do that to yourself?
Why would you do that? I have no idea.
This is fine. but it's about finding that time to put into that you know, yeah. Matt Mercer doesn't necessarily have to worry about, games companies don't necessarily have to worry about, because they have a whole dedicated team of writers working on that stuff. So
the two things I'll say about the Matt Mercer effect, like, then I'm going back to video games. The first thing is that when players come to your table wanting Critical Role, you just have to explain to them, well, if you want me to be Matt Mercer, you guys need to be everyone else.
Yes, yes.
You get out of your GM what you put in. If you give them all the stuff on the same level as like Laura and Sam and Liam and all that, then yes, your game is going to be higher quality because the GM has so much to work with. Like, hell yeah. Like V was saying about the world building and working with your GM to make part of the world. A lot of GMs are happy to do that because, like, you're invested now. When I mention this name, you're going to freak out because you know who that is.
Yeah, I think that, to do a really good segue, that kind of brings it back to game designers, because if you have a player that isn't going to pay attention to what's happening and they just want to run and gun and shoot stuff, then you are limited with the kind of things that you're going to be able to do. So, you know, someone telling a story in, let's say, Call of Duty is not going to be able to have the same kind of trust in their player as something like Journey, for example. Journey has no dialogue at all and tells a story specifically without any kind of dialogue. The same as like Hyperlight Drifter has no story through spoken word or on screen text. It's just through bizarre dream sequences. I love Hyperlight Drifter. I still really don't understand the story, but I love it. Like, I know it's about, there's like corruption of some description, and there's a dream, and there's big skeleton men, and it's beautiful, and he's got a sword. That's all I got. That's all I know when it comes to Hyperlight Drifter. But it's
one of those games like the Souls games where it's like, if you go down in the wiki, you'll find some lore.
Oh, yeah. For sure. And there's a... Yeah, so go ahead.
I was going to say, I have a similar thing with Dear Esther. It's very much, in terms of games, it's a walk. It's a walk. And it's a beautiful walk. And the music is... Oh, my God, the music it makes me cry every time I hear it. But it's very much a walk that you experience, and you understand the story through the things that you see and the things that you pick up. And there's no other physical characters around to talk to or to engage with. So it's just discovering things and uncovering things as you go. Very much the same way that Hyperlight Drifter is just finding stuff and going, okay, this adds to the story. This is what this means. So
I haven't played Dear Esther. I played Gone Home. How much of Dear Esther is like text pages and things like that, like hidden documents and stuff like that, or voice files and things like that?
That's the story, basically.
Right. right.
It is, like, when I say it is a walk, that's it.
It's a walking simulator.
It's a walking simulator with extra steps.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
Yeah. Which is like Firewatch as well, is the same kind of thing, but everyone loved Firewatch for the story that they told,
yes.
Right?
Firewatch was visually a beautiful game as well. And
correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Firewatch and Dear Esther do the same thing where, like, yes, it's a walking simulator. Technically speaking, there's no, like, what you could call traditional, like, gameplay in terms of interacting with the world. But every now and again, it's both exploration in terms of having to find a way in.
Yes.
It's one of the instances. Yes. And the other instance is just pushing buttons.
Yeah. I think the key difference between Dear Esther and Firewatch is that Dear Esther feels very much like a solo thing. Like, because there isn't really anyone on the other end of the phone, whereas with Firewatch, you are constantly talking to someone on the end of the phone.
Right.
Except for when you're out in the, you know, the
wilderness. Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
you come back to base and you have this, you establish this relationship with someone on the other end of a phone, and how that plays out is an important driving force of the story. Whereas with Dear Esther, it's just you wash up on a beach and you have to figure out what happened here.
I think the thing for me that I struggle with is that a lot of these games are all very indie, and I understand that they have to kind of rely on crutches to tell their story, which ends up being voice files and, you know, left behind notes and stuff. But then on a game like BioShock or a game like System Shock or those kind of games, you'll often see people judge that game for relying on those crutches that they have. It's a lazy way of storytelling for bigger budget studios, but for indie studios, they're given a pass to try and tell that story. And it kind of then highlights the games that don't use that are indie titles. You know, you look at like Hollow Knight doesn't really have text files or voice files. You'll have a couple of people will say things. You have some plinths. You'll have some plinths that have like a rhyme or a riddle or what have you.
The quote unquote world building.
Yes, but it's all so subtle in Hollow Knight because they don't rely on that. And I think that then that adds, I don't know, what do you, like, maybe I, just my opinion, but I feel like allowing the player to decide how deep they want to go into that lore and how awake they want to pay attention to it seems like a thing to me. But
I just want clarification on what you mean by the lazy way of telling a story in terms of...
Yes, I just, like, I think for indie titles, it's used as a way of story.
What specifically it is, as in the exploration or...
No,
or
like, the... so you'll have, like, video voice files
that you pick up a thing and it's
you
like,
pick up a thing and it plays a thing
exposition
yes. Or you have like a diary page that you find and then that's there, but in indie games that's relied on a lot and isn't critique. That's not something that they're critiqued for, but then big budget ones they are.
The nutshell of that is literally when you do that in an indie game, that's the entire game. It's finding these things and progressing the story, whereas with BioShock, that is an extra thing you can use to gain more knowledge about the world. Would you want to say something?
I was about to say that you mentioned Hollow Knight, you activated Glaive Trap God. Yeah. 100%.
I'm resisting. I'm resisting.
Talk about it. It's one of my favorite games. It's good.
Yeah. I personally understand why people have those complaints, but I feel like the people who have those complaints aren't necessarily the people who are playing those indie games.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like they're going into stuff like BioShock and going, I want to play the action part. I want to do the cool underwater fighting big things and hitting things with a wrench and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily going to be the same people who want to play Journey.
Yeah.
And I know this is a bit of a generalization. I'm sticking to it.
I haven't said this in a while. It's another bit we have. No such thing as an absolute.
It's been a while, hasn't it? Damn.
It has been a while, strangely. People were getting tired of me saying it, so I held off for a bit. but every game, be it tabletop or video game, has different kinds of players. Depending on what you want, it has multiple ways of approaching it. So you've got your lore nerds who are just want it for the story and want to... just want to find every little bit that tells them more about what the world is like. You've got the guys who just want to shoot things and like, shooty, bang, bang, kill the thing. Mm. You've got your loot goblins who just want to collect everything. And these all have Venn diagrams. Like, they're all one big mess of, like, some people are a mixture and all that jazz. So when you have, again, a game like Dear Esther... The approach to that game is a lot more restrictive than to a AAA game, because the indie game is trying to tell one story in one specific way, and you can have five different people play Dear Esther. The difference is the person. It's not the style of play. What they get out of it is unique to them because of their experiences.
Well, that's the best kind of storytelling, I
exactly.
think. That's the best kind of games design where every player that plays it can get some level of storytelling and feel satisfied with it.
Yeah.
I think that's why Hollow Knight works as well as it does, is that you know, there's people that will just do the boss fights and enjoy the storytelling with what's her name? Nail? No, what's it?
Hornet.
Hornet. God, Nail is the sword. Yeah. With Hornet, you know, and kind of understand it just from what people tell the player. And then there's other people that will really go deep into the level design and kind of understand what's really kind of happened there and be more observant about it. There was an MMO I was playing. I can't remember what it was called off the top of my head. I'm sorry. I played a 14-day trial of this MMO that tried to add puzzles to the game that revolved around random things in the world. Telling stories that you had to be observant about and actually leave the game and Google stuff.
Oof.
To be able to actually solve that puzzle. And and I think that is such a cutoff for so many players. You're narrowing yourself to only having the people that are like, I know what kind of game this is, I'm going into it. And then, you know, when you compare that, you know, that's, I'd say that's like the complete opposite of something like, you know, Hollow Knight or Undertale, where like you can go in and have these kind of freedom of the player to be as observant as they're able to, you know, without it affecting the enjoyment of the player.
I have a funny example of that from a game I've sorry, my brain, every now and again my brain works faster than my mouth does. There is a streamer, a friend of the show, Liberty,
shout out to Liberty,
who was playing Conker's Bad Fur Day, which I had never seen before. I knew of its existence, but I had never seen anyone play it before. And I learned a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely a game.
It is definitely a game. But the interesting thing about it, and this is ever so slight... spoilers for a more than a decade-old game. Insert that duck.
Please never ask me to insert a duck ever again.
There is a bit in the game... and it's a very quite linear game from what I can tell, except for a few quite annoying platforming parts, which aren't very well designed. But there's a point in the game where you cannot progress because you need a grand in terms of cash. Mm. And you might not necessarily have this grand of cash.
Mm.
And to me, that was a moment of like, well, they should have just, like, what is the purpose of that block?
Yes.
Like, why is that there? As a game designer, why have you stopped the player from progressing? Because now they have to go back. And there's not much for them to do because they've already done everything.
Yeah, for sure.
Unless you've put something around in a corner, which you've just got an annoyed player going around like, where the hell? I'm missing 300. Where is the last 300? What the hell?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think designers can be their own worst enemy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's also something that can happen in D&D. I had this instance of not giving my players enough information and having them miss what I thought was quite an obvious plot hook, but I'd put it behind a skill check. And they kept failing the skill check because dice be like that sometimes.
This is when you lower the DC.
Yeah, I did, and I still kept failing. Like, geez, like, it was a bad rolling day, trust me. I was like, okay, so the DC is this. Okay, cool. Well, they keep missing it. All right, well, I'll lower it to, like, 10. Nope. It just wasn't on the cards. And so they, so this village where people kept going missing, and there'd been someone had like sent a letter to the city for help, and they'd seen this letter and gone, oh, let's go help them. And they got there and nothing seemed to miss at all because they kept failing the checks. And I was
well,
I've done this to myself. I learned from this. And,
yeah.
And in the end, they managed to go back and fix it, and it was all fine. But it was a whole session of them just chasing their tails.
Can I ask what like the MacGuffin was, as in what was the check?
It was a perception check.
Oh,
like,
no.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
This was before we'd had that conversation about passive, okay?
Mm. Yeah, there's passive. So, like, to remind people what the passive check is. So, every check, passive perception is, like, from our first episode. Woo!
What a throwback.
10 plus whatever you add to your perception roll usually is your passive. It's like your average, what you would see if someone is hiding and they are hiding with a stealth check of 9, your passive with 10 plus whatever or minus whatever, if you have more than 9, they can see you without having to roll. Which is handy as a GM. If you're hiding something and you're like, hey, Bob is an elf. Bob can see this because Bob has eyes, not to be stereotypical.
What do your elf eyes see, Bob?
Exactly.
There's a chest over there. What the fuck?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
But if it comes to like stuff like, and this is also a video gamey thing. If a video game wants to get your attention, there are very easy ways of getting your attention. Be it a giant exclamation point above a thing or... just a different color. I just reminded of the Mirror's Edge has specific colors as to where the player can go.
Yes.
And another example is the latest Resident Evil, where anything you can interact with has safety tape on it.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a thing for Resident Evil games for quite a while. Anything that was something that was important or interactable had yellow on it. But they've really kind of made it a little bit more subtle by making sure it looks like tape now, which is just really, really good kind of way of not necessarily masking it, but making sure that it's still tape. Like making sure that it's still obvious to the players that this is still a thing that they can use, but having it look less out of place.
So yeah,
tied into the game. It's tied into the exactly. It exists in the world as opposed to it being like a shining big beacon above it or something.
Like,
that breaks
why
the
is
immersion.
That glowing? That shouldn't glow.
Yeah.
Like
at
this point, I've mentioned this many times before, and I'm going to continue to mention it many times. My big bad of my campaign of 5 years is Valdari, a chaos god, and his main thing is the color purple. So anytime I mention the color purple, the player's ears prop up. We're like, all right, what's going on? Where is he? Where the fuck is he?
RIP, my favorite color, by the way.
Yeah. I think going back to your perception check story, I think that's something that a lot of designers still struggle with when it comes to video games, especially in open world games, because I was watching, I can't remember the creator. I came ill prepared. But there was a creator discussing, I think it was on TikTok actually, discussing the Korok. Who's the Korok dude in Breath of the Wild with the maracas? I don't remember what the name is off the top of my head. But like the person on TikTok was talking about how
Destu.
Okay. How he was playing and found Destu straight away. But then his brother, Hestu. So he played it, found Hestu, it was fine. But then his brother played it and never learned what the Korok seeds were for because he didn't go the way the game wanted him to go because it's an open world game. So he'd collected all of the Korok seeds and never expanded his inventory slots. And so then apparently one of the developers had talked about it where they were trying to figure out
how to put Hester what, you in know front
whether
of
they whether they should put Hester in different locations depending on what, like, have a radius where wherever mm-hmm. you are, as long as you're on a main path, Hester will show up, and if you don't, then Hester shows up somewhere else. But then they decided against it for some reason, and so it just has this one location, and that's something that you have to incorporate into your storytelling, in that, like, if it's a vital plot, you can't have it just, you know, if it's a vital plot point or a vital thing for the game, you can't just have it in one location, especially in an open world game.
It's literally from the first edition of D&D, GMs have always done the fact that, like, I want my players to go to this town. Oh, they mm-hmm. went to the other side. We're going to put this town over here town. In front of them.
just pick it up and move it. That's fine. Mm. And that's essentially what I had to do with the perception check thing, was mm-hmm. that I had them meet someone in a different city who was like, this sounds intriguing. Let's go find out together. And then they got there and everyone had gone missing. And I was like, oh, this is a lot less subtle. This is fine.
Yeah.
And it all got resolved and it was fine. But it was very much a kind of that moment of realizing that if it's something you want the players to see, you can't put it behind any kind of roadblock.
Because otherwise, I think it just you then end up having a lesser product. Like I think with that Breath of the Wild story, you know the player is going to have less satisfaction with what they did. They're going to be like, why did they not give me more inventory slots? Why did they not, you know? And because Breath of the Wild really tried to be as hands off as possible, there's no real tool tips for, like, here's how you expand your inventory mm-hmm. unless you meet Hester beforehand, right? So then it becomes this thing of like, well, how much freedom is too much freedom, and how much how much of the story is vital for player satisfaction and the payoff that you get for playing a game.
I've played all of like 2 hours of Breath of the Wild. I really struggle with it because it's so hands off. Mm-hmm. I really like, and the beginning is fairly like, there's a guy telling you what to do. Like, he's like, hey, if you go and get me this, I can give you this. Mm. But I still, like, I was like, this is too much freedom. I need a bit more structure than this. I need to know that the things that I'm doing are going to make sense in like 2 hours.
I also do enjoy the fact that as soon as you exit the cave, it's like, hey, you see that big glowing mountain in distance? You have to go there eventually. Mm. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. There's the game. Good luck. It's like, okay.
Yeah, it's like, okay, cool. But the whole country is on giant cliff faces and plates, and I don't know how to get down there. Also, that area is really cold, and I'm going to die. Cool. Yes.
Which is a fun realization.
Well, yeah, but that tutorial area is great. I mean, they're still telling you story. They're still telling it to you rather than you experiencing it. But that whole, well, yeah. And
yeah, yeah,
and
they're so showing you. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're telling you to some extent. You know, there's still like a cutscene of the king telling you stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, by the way, I'm the king and I'm dead and blah, blah, blah. But especially for people who've played Zelda already, there's a lot of stuff that you don't get told, that you just see it straight away. And in that tutorial area, you're basically given a walkthrough of each area of what it's like to be, you know, hey, this is a cold area. You will be affected by X, Y, and Z. You'll freeze your ass off and you'll die. These fruits will help you from not dying and what those kind of things. But then if you don't have, like, I think I saw like one speedrunner complete the whole game without the glider.
Oh wow.
I think I saw a speedrunner do it without the glider. And like if a speedrunner can do it, then perhaps there are players that figure out how to get down without triggering that
ever
story.
Talking to the old man, yeah.
Yeah, if you don't talk to the old man and the story doesn't progress, you don't get the items that are needed. And then that then affects the satisfaction and the payoff of the game. And so you might have people that you lose, you lose potential customers and potential gamers from playing your game because, well, this game's broken. I can't get off the island or whatever.
I mean, they're not always getting it right in terms of storytelling. Leads me very nicely onto Mass Effect. Because what Bloody did they get that wrong?
I want to quickly, before we get down the Mass Effect hole, I just want to very quickly talk about another example of a game doing the opposite, restricting your path so that you go a specific path and ingest into it. And it's only like a very short story. Fallout New Vegas.
Yes!
Fallout New Vegas, you start the game in a town after being shot in the head. Spoiler alert. you have to have your character creation interview with the doctor going like, oh, you did this or this, and all that jazz. And then as soon as you exit out, unless you speak to NPCs and explore the town, and they will tell you, hey, don't go left, go right. Because if you go left, you will die.
Yeah.
to that, I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Oh, really? That's not the dialogue?
I would love it, right?
But me having first played New Vegas, I was like, but Vegas is over there. I can see it. Mm-hmm, I want to go over there. I start going down there, and I learn that Bethesda doesn't want me to go down there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I run, and I make it.
Nice! You made it there.
I just ran, and I was like, oh no, these bugs are huge. Oh dear. And it's, I feel like, I obviously don't know the percentage of players who went left, but I'd be willing to say quite a few. Like, a high percentage of like, no, you can't tell me what to do. Which is a common occurrence in gaming. Like, the tiny tabletop tidbit I'd say that's the equivalent of that is when you have a brand new player to Dungeons and Dragons, you don't say, hey, play Barbarian because it's easy. Because I think the Wizards of the Coast at some point were like, well, we could put a tidbit in the game like, maybe you shouldn't play Wizard as your first class. But they found during playtesting, every time they did that, people were like, no, fuck you, I'm playing a wizard. Like, okay,
right, cool. Yeah, absolutely. You give people freedom, then you can't limit that freedom.
Exactly.
100%.
Yeah.
Mass Effect.
Tell me about Mass Effect, then, V.
Mass Effect. All right. I was late to the Mass Effect train. I didn't start playing Mass Effect until just before 3 came out. I played the first one. I really enjoyed the story. I was kind of still fairly new to BioWare in general. For those of you who don't know, BioWare, very good at story games. Super great at story games, actually. Dragon Age Origins. Chef's kiss. Love that. Dragon Age 2. You know. My issues with Dragon Age 2 have nothing to do with the story and everything to do with the recycled maps. But that's a different thing. Mass Effect 1. Great. Loved it. Super, super loved everyone. Didn't romance anyone because, hi, I'm Ace. What's up?
Yeah.
And... Yeah. is that how we're saying it now?
I don't know.
I missed the last meeting.
Ace. I like that.
We're just all the fonts. It's fine.
Right, it's fine. Oh my god, how much of a twist would that be if the fonts had been asexual?
Both misunderstands everything.
New canon alert, I'm here for it. Anyway. I was playing through Mass Effect 2 when 3 came out. I was really excited. I really liked the high stakes situations that you were put in with Mass Effect 2 because you weren't working for the Alliance anymore. You were working for the bad guys. You were working for Cerberus and you were working with the Elusive Man. Excellent acting, by the way. Chef's kiss. And the way that that all tied up was brilliant. And the way that the story ended up was fantastic. And I was so excited for Mass Effect 3. And for the most part, quack, quack, Mass Effect 3 is really good. It's got some really beautiful story beats. It's got some wonderful tying ups of certain loose ends. I will never get over the fact that my partner of the time somehow, through his choices in the previous games, managed to get the perfect Conrad ending. Somehow, because you have to really work for that.
Yeah.
I didn't get that because I don't give a shit about this guy, but he somehow managed it. And I was watching just like, how?
Yeah.
How did you do this?
What magic have you placed upon this game?
And the stakes get even higher, and it's fate of the universe kind of stuff. And then you get to the last sequence and you stumble onto the Citadel. You've just sat with Anderson has passed away and I'm not emotionally prepared for that nonsense. Boy, howdy. And you stumble out and there's a kid.
Yeah.
It's that fucking kid. And I hate that kid anyway, but that's because I'm not a children person. And And to be honest, the use of the same child's face in the dream sequences, I kind of was like, I feel no connection to this kid. Yes. I don't really care who this kid is.
Yes.
Not everyone is going to have that instinctive, quote unquote, connection or bond with a child. They're just not.
Yeah.
Now, if it was a puppy.
Oh, boy, howdy, that'd be a different issue.
Yeah. That kid also, I think the problem is that it's an emotional crutch for sure, but I also think that the engine was not built to try and convey that subtlety of sadness that Shepard was supposed to try and convey. So, you know, this kid is like disappearing and reappearing and he's just like blank faced because they can't animate the face properly because it's a 15-year-old game or whatever.
It's the same time as LA Noir, wasn't it? So like it's the same
That's the problem. They should have done LA Noir facial animation.
No, that's my point exactly. It's like, well, yeah, this is what yeah, was coming out at that time. It's like, oh,
we weren't quite there with the technology. I think
if they'd have done it with you know, if Naughty Dog had been in charge of the animation, we would have been able to see some more emotion on Shepard's face.
For sure,
Perhaps we would get a little bit more of why we should care that he's seeing a child in general.
My general attitude towards my Shepard's blank face to pretty much everything was that she's seen so much shit, she's just dead inside now. So
yeah, exactly.
Sure. So we get to the ending, and there's that ghost kid who represents the universe, I guess, who fucking knows by the end of it. And you get to make a choice. And it's the last choice of the game of three games that are hugely about making choices and living with the consequences of them.
Yeah.
It is really important to get this last choice right.
Yeah.
And they don't. Yeah. Because it boils down to you kind of get the same ending regardless of what you pick, except it's a different color.
Yeah.
Cool.
No.
Yes.
Great. And for someone who generally, and this comes as no surprise to anyone at the table, someone who generally picks the Paragon choices.
Same. It's totally same. Totally same. I can't be a bad guy in games. I can't. Right?
Yeah, yeah, I'm the chaotic one.
Nobody is surprised by that. I'll pick the Renegade options if it's funny, but most of the time, Paragon. Yeah. To get to the end and to find that the ending that I had believed to be the correct one was in fact the red ending. Are you kidding me right now?
Yeah.
And then you have the problem of, like you said before, because you don't get the satisfaction of the payoff, it affects how you view the next games that they put out.
Mm-hmm.
So Andromeda has its own problems, don't get me wrong, but isn't a bad game. But because of what happened with Mass Effect 3, BioWare lost a lot of trust with their fans for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reception of it was underwhelming, to say the least.
I'm one of those people, I can't. Like, I'm going to do it for, like, a YouTube video or something where like, me and Nikki play it or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because it's just the most... We're both huge fans of Mass Effect, and so then having this new game that was not made by the same people that was just like seems it's the Stargate Atlantis or the Stargate universe of Mass Effect.
How dare you? How dare you?
I love Atlantis. Stargate universe needed to be way more it's undercooked, to say the least.
We're gonna drag Miles onto an episode in the future and talk about Stargate exclusively for way too long. You do realize
that's gonna be the busiest episode we ever have, because I am my first fandom on the internet was SG-1.
Yeah.
I go deep on this shit, we're all
on the same page for Stargate. Oh, so it's like, let's do a Stargate episode.
Yes.
Let's do it. Okay, cool beans. So Mass Effect like really suffered for that. And we've seen it now. Like, there's nothing new coming out for Andromeda. Whereas Mass Effect, the first three games, got a lot of love and a lot of DLC.
Yep. Yeah.
And I honestly, like, I know they're doing something, but I don't really care what they're doing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't they,
the Mass Effect stuff.
I've never played Dragon Age. Didn't they also burn their bridge for Dragon Age with their storytelling?
A little bit, but only, it wasn't nearly as bad as the Mass Effect situation, because for Mass Effect, it was the end of a big story, whereas Dragon Age is continuing to go. Like the Dragon Age 4, also known as Dragon Age.
Ugh.
Don't even get me started on the title thing. I'm still mad about that. Dragon Age 2 comes before Dragon Age. Are you fucking kidding me? Really? But yeah.
Didn't they rename the first one Dragon Age Origins?
It was always Origins.
Okay, of course.
It was always Origins. It was Origins 2, Inquisition, Dragon Age.
Ugh.
What? It's ridiculous. So there were certain issues with how Inquisition ended, because honestly there were the whole Mages versus Templars thing is a big morality issue that a lot of the kind of the narrative fans. It's interesting because you go back again to different types of players. You have the kind of the narrative driven players and the people who just want to hit things with sticks.
The
narrative driven fans think that this morality issue is cut and dry. You have to pick the Mages. Absolutely. If you pick the Templars, you're a terrible, terrible person. And I picked the Templars. And I was balls deep in this fandom. I got a lot of shit for that.
This is why
it's the same thing in Skyrim. It's the exact same thing in Skyrim. You have to pick one of the things, except the difference is that they're all bad. And there's no good choices. So of all the factions, you have to choose. Like, well, you're racist.
Yeah.
You're imperialist.
That's what a lot of these kind of games boil down to. And I love the fact that they don't go, this is correct and this is incorrect.
Yeah.
And that, you know, morality becomes a case of morality is a luxury for a lot of people, I think. And I think it's very easy to forget that, because a lot of us playing these games are in comfortable positions. You know, it's easy to kind of like detach yourself from that and go, well, of course the Mages are in the right. And it's like, well, no, they're not, because they're the ones abusing this, that, and the other. I'm kind of getting off track from what I was saying.
Yes.
Surprise, surprise. And and so they've discovered that a big part of why people came back for Inquisition after kind of a lackluster response to Dragon Age 2 was because of one particular character. And it's interesting which character that they brought back, because for Inquisition, they brought back one companion from 2, which they didn't do for the first one. No one came back from that. And then they brought back Varric Tethrys. He is a storyteller. He is the framing device for which Dragon Age 2 works around. It is him telling the story of your hero to someone who is asking questions. And it's a great framing device, and it almost excuses the lazy design work in terms of the maps and stuff, because you can just say, well, he couldn't be bothered to remember all the descriptive points, so everything looks the same.
that's kind of like what they do with Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, is that he's telling the story, and so all of the enemies look the same, and you're just like, yeah, he's probably just remembering one of them.
Every time you die, it's like, well, that's not
like,
quite
how
it went.
No, that's not how it went.
Yeah, exactly. 100%, that's exactly what it is. And I love it as an excuse, but it's a lazy excuse.
It's a cheat.
We didn't think of this until after the fact.
Yeah.
And he's coming back for the fourth one as well. And so there was a lot of people, and I was one of these people, where I was quite nervous about what they were bringing out, and I was like, I don't know if I'm going to play it. Like, I love Dragon Age. Like, Dragon Age is like has my soul in a vice like grip, but I wasn't sure about Dragon Age 4. And in the trailer they released, the little teaser trailer that they released, which was all we got during BioWare's big old thing, they were like, hey, here's a load of Mass Effect news you don't care about, and also a tiny little thing for Dragon Age, was a trailer where they had the voiceover was the character that they were bringing back, Varric Tethrys. And a lot of people went, all right, we're in. Because they're so invested in that story.
Yeah, yeah.
They're invested in his story and where he's come from and what he's doing next. And also it helps that Brian Blum is an amazing voice actor. So, yeah, that's great too.
Exactly, yeah. So it's I think it just that kind of, that's where we are now, is that I think we're moving forward. We move for stories that we connect with more than anything else.
And I think that's kind of why stories like games like you mentioned earlier, Call of Duty doesn't have much of a plot, but it's starting to. Halo has a story.
Halo's always had a story.
But it's having more of a story. Like, I'm hearing more about it in terms of, like, this.
They're definitely pushing it in the marketing for Halo. The second one was just like, the first one didn't really market itself on its story.
No,
it was an Xbox exclusive. That was its big marketing push.
But I think that's exactly why, because basically, you can look at it as like it's Call of Duty versus Halo. It's these two fandoms that are against each other. But they were doing the stories in different ways. Call of Duty was trying to do stories, monkeying over games, trying to be like, we need cinematics, we need bits, we need big plot points and all that. Like, yes, but you're playing a shooty-shooty game. The average player of the shooty-shooty game isn't going to give a shit about world politics. They're just wanting to get in and go. So the player autonomy, the more of that you take away, the less invested they're going to be. Whereas Halo does a lot more of that, where it's a lot more story as you go. There are cinematics, but a lot of the plot is happening as you're running around this path and going like, oh crap, there's a ship coming in. Uh-oh.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, and that kind of brings us kind of to, wow, I said kind of three times there. It brings us back full circle to Half-Life, because Halo was heavily inspired by Half-Life, and they try a lot to have set pieces happen to the player rather than during a cutscene, unless it's like outside of the player's vision. You know, if there's a ship is crashing into another, they want to give you that payoff to see the ship crash and what have you, and see the Halo in space and whatever. But they also want to lean into the kind of things that Half-Life pioneered with the, you know, a guy shooting you to make you turn and see the big thing.
I find it really interesting that I've never had an Xbox. I've never been too much into Halo, but I've just absorbed its lore and stuff through osmosis. So it's weird to have a favorite game in a franchise that I haven't played that much of. And yet I do. I'm a big fan of Halo Reach because I find that with all the other games, despite the fact that Master Chief is designed specifically for players like a blank slate that any player can go in and be like, I'm Master Chief, I'm going to be the best ass in this universe. Whereas Reach didn't do any of that. The main character of Reach is literally just a complete blank slate, which you customize yourself. It is your guy, 100%. And you know, because of the lore of the first game, that you're fucked. You know from the get-go that Reach falls, so you're unlikely to survive.
Right.
So this gives them the opportunity of introducing all these interesting characters and going through this plot of like, yeah, you know, you're going to lose. We all know you're going to lose. But it's getting there is the interest. It's the journey, not the destination.
That's perfect. That's like, that's video games in general. It's not about the ending, V. It's about it's about the friends we made and watched die
just
along
the
way.
Friends we made along the way. I think that's a pretty good place to end it, ironically. It's all good. It's all fine.
If we learn nothing from this podcast, it's just that it's about the friends we got to watch die along the way.
Yeah. I'm perfect.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's, again, like, 90% of the D&D campaign, just to talk about that for a second, is that the players don't remember the big plot points of your world. The players remember the silly shit that they did amongst themselves, or the cool thing that they did, because I've mentioned this before as well. When players talk about that time that they almost fell off a cliff, to their death, but a bunch of players came over and dragged them up. Their brains, that like scientists have scanned their brains, and it's coming from actual memory. It's not coming from imaginary memory. And I think video games do this as well to a certain extent, where like you're not talking about it as, oh, Master Chief did this. It's like, no. I did this.
I am the Master Commander. Yes.
And this is why we're all so invested in these stories, because unlike books or movies or that, these are all things that we can't interact with. We just consume.
Yes.
Darrow Breen has a great comedic bit where he's like, video games are very unique, as well as tabletop games, except tabletop has the ability to react to each nuance, where, like, you read a book, it's if books work the same way, it's like, you read, like, suddenly there's a question about the book, like, you can't answer, poof! Like, oh, yeah. God, okay, cool. I'll get back to it. It's fine. I'm stuck on that bit. That's fine.
I love that you bring in an Irish comedian to this. Like, come on, my guy. Come on.
I'm Irish.
Oh.
Not many other comedians have video game bits.
It's true. Okay. I think that's a good hopping off point for us.
Hey, Miles. What do you want to plug?
Such tact, such subtlety in your programming.
We do this every time we have a guest.
We just shout at them. We're like, "Hey, what do you want to do?"
I don't know. Watch my show. The Next Step. If you're in Canada or the UK or Australia,
BBC iPlayer.
BBC iPlayer, CBC Gem in Canada.
Season seven is the one I'm in.
The Next Step.
Yeah.
And then I'm on all of the things, Miles_Dobson. Come watch me on Twitch at times. I don't know when I stream, but you can follow me and you get notifications.
Generally from 2 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays.
But not guaranteed.
but not guaranteed. Because real life is a thing.
Real life is a thing.
We will, of course, put all the usual links into the description of the podcast. Mm-hmm.
Check out Miles' TikTok. Check out Miles' Twitch. Check out Miles' Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. I hear he has great mods.
I've heard he hangs out with some really cool people. As always, check Danny out on Twitch. Twitch.tv/GlaveThruster.
My schedule is also not guaranteed right now. We'll get to it.
I'm the only one with a schedule that seems to be working right now, which is hysterical to me.
All right, give me a week.
Right? Check me out on Twitch, twitch.tv/Vehlr, V-E-H-L-R. Also, the usual places to ask us questions, because next week will be a review episode and we will be answering questions. Email us cannibalizingthecanon@gmail.com. That's cannibalizing with a Z.
Or ask
check
questions.
Us out on Twitter, Cannibal Canon.
Yeah. And also V's Discord.
Also my Discord. Come and check out my Discord and come make friends with us. It's a good time.
We have a whole cannibalizing the canon section.
Also, I don't know if you're into Christmas stuff, but we have a merch store.
Yeah. Yay! Chill.
Chill for my life.
We have sold how many things have we sold? We've sold like two things, right?
No, we've sold like three things.
Holy crap. One of those things we have no idea. We know it's in Ireland. We have no idea who bought it.
We have a fan in Ireland and we don't know who it is. It's very concerning.
I love it. Good job, guys. I'm so proud of you getting this thing off the ground. It's been great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We'll probably have you on again in the future for a Stargate episode.
Yes,
Doctor Who episode, but I might leave you.
We're going to wait until we're a good few episodes into the next season before we talk about Doctor Who.
That Doctor Who episode is going to be three-parter.
That's going to be a whole separate podcast, let's be real.
Oh, yeah, let's go.
We'll just have an entire episode of, like, Chris Chibnall and what not to do.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you for having me.
Again, I've been Glaive/Danny/ whatever the heck you want to call me.
I've been V/Vella/Rin/ three ducks in a trench coat, apparently, now. What the fuck is this? Quack, quack.
Oh, do I do a sign out as well?
No, you could.
That would be great. That's fun.
And I'm that snotty nephew that keeps wanting to say, hey, you got any games on your phone? Miles Dobson.
Oh, very seasonal. And this has been Cannibalizing the Canon. Bye.
Bye.